This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What grosses you out? The sight of maggots squirming on a rotten piece of meat? How about a cockroach running around your spice cabinet when you turn the lights on it? How about eating a strange organ meat like sweetbreads? Like the pancreas. Maybe just a doorknob is enough to give you the chills, touched by so many hands. Or a toilet seat touched by... Well, you know, there must be so many germs, right? Well, where does that sense of disgust come from? Why is it something that is disgusting to one person, a delicacy to another? And does it serve a purpose? Keep us safe from disease, for example. Just a few of the things discussed in my next guest book, That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. Rachel Herz is the author. She's also a research psychologist and teaches at Brown University in Providence. She joins us from Rhode Island Public Radio. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira. It's very nice to talk to you again.
I have to say, I enjoy saying the name of your book more than I think a lot of other books we review. That's disgusting.
Well, I like how you say it, too.
you use the word in your book, pure yuckiness. What does that mean?
Well, that's basically trying to get at the really visceral, raw dimension of disgust that's not very cognitive, not very thought through. It's that really creepy, yucky feeling of, for instance, stepping in dog poop accidentally or, you know, looking into a public toilet and noticing that it hasn't been flushed and used a lot of times, that kind of thing. So it's very physical and basic.
You should warn people we're going to get this disgusting this hour. But one of the fascinating things you learn in your book is that these are things that have to be learned, right? Traits. Not everybody's disgusted the same way. You learn how to be disgusted by things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes to a big surprise for most people that the idea that, you know, toilets not flushed and things like that would not be inherently disgusting. But actually, we first learn that poop is disgusting with potty training, and that lesson usually takes place around the age of 3. But before that, you know, newborns and young children will play with their feces and have no problem. Young kids as well, older than 3, have no problems, you know, picking up something dead off the ground and bringing it to mommy to show them, and things like this that we really have to become socialized to learn what the signals of disgust are.
And interestingly, you open your book talking about some of the strange foods that people eat around the world to make a point that different cultures are disgusted by different things.
Absolutely. And so that's a great place to see learning kind of writ large. When you look at a culture and you see these vast differences in, for instance, what fermented deliciousness is preferred in any given culture and how another culture consider it absolutely repulsive. I think a great example, in fact, is cheese, just because it's so simple. And for us, it seems most of the time, I think, to be anything from a comfort food to a real delicacy. And for instance, Asians consider it to be the equivalent of cow excrement. So the idea that we adore something and other cultures find it hideous, you know, we think, well, that's not logical. But there are things in Asia that they eat that we would find entirely repulsive. But the interesting underlying thing here is that none of these foods are in fact dangerous. So it's not like we're ingesting poisons and don't those Asians know better than to be eating 100-year-old eggs and they're going to be falling over any second, or don't those Westerners know that that cheese riddled with blue stuff is poison? So it's interesting that all these products are, in fact, safe, and the origins of disgust are really about protecting us from things that would be poison.
So there's no natural disgust genes in us that will when we taste something, we say we spit it out thinking that's poisonous.
Well, that's actually not true. It is the case that bitter is inherently unpleasant, and we will spit that out instantly if we can, if something bitter gets in our mouth. And that's because bitter is typically a signal for high levels of alkaloids, which typically signal poison. And so the bitter taste reaction is hardwired and is ingrained from birth, and we will try to expel those kinds of tasting things. But beyond that, the disgust reaction, which goes well beyond the idea of spitting out bitter taste, is learned and culturally determined.
Mm-hmm. You were mentioning that when you give even young infants a little taste of something a little bitter, that they make the disgusting face right from the beginning.
Right. That was actually one of the things that first really turned me on to the field of disgust. I thought it was completely fascinating that a basic taste, like bitter, instantly from birth would elicit the expression in a newborn that you would make if I said, could you please hold your neighbor's dirty dentures?
Disgusting.
So I think that, yes, but it's very interesting. And the origins and also the part of the brain that controls taste is the same as the part of the brain that controls disgust. So the fundamental origins of disgust are rooted in our perception of taste, and particularly the rejection of bitter taste, which, as I said before, tend to indicate toxins. But from then, it really morphs into something very complex, abstract, and uniquely human.
Is it possible to unlearn something that you learned to be disgusting?
Yes, I think definitely. I mean, at least you can modulate it down. So people who, for example, have to be exposed to disgusting things for periods of time develop tolerances to them and find them okay. So, for example, people who are emergency workers or work in hospitals and have to deal with blood and guts and body fluids all the time may initially begin their jobs feeling highly repulsed by these sorts of things, but then they just become used to it. And so we can definitely become inured to the signals of disgust. It's also the case that our culture, again, what we're used to, can make a big difference in terms of what we find disgusting. If, you know, there are no sewers around and waste is everywhere, then, for instance, the smell would be, you know, the smell equivalent maybe to a fast food restaurant here. You know, it's not maybe your favorite smell, but it's everywhere and it's okay.
Mm-hmm. But is repulsive the same as disgusting? I'm thinking of a smell like a skunk smell that's sort of universally disgusting, right?
I mean, I'm actually someone who likes the smell of skunk, and I'm not alone. As a matter of fact, I've met many people who confess to this. And interestingly, you know, smell is my primary area of expertise, and I discovered while working on disgust that there are a lot of fundamental commonalities. And the reason why, for instance, the smell of skunk is not universally unpleasant is because our responses to smell are learned, just like our responses to disgust are. So if you first encounter the smell of skunk in a context where you thought it was a good smell, you will then think it's a good smell. And if you didn't get schooled in, ooh, that's disgusting, you'll be surprised later on if you make this confession.
I have heard other people say that. But I guess what I was meant to say was that the skunk has that smell for a reason, right? And it must be because most things or most animals find it disgusting and repulsive.
Well, it's dealing with its own specific local predators, and we are not part of the skunk, you know, typical predator domain. I mean, we don't go around eating them. We may accidentally kill them by running them over, but we're not part of the skunk natural predator system. So the natural predators of skunk would be repelled by that scent. So we don't necessarily fall into that category, and that's why there's nothing built in for us.
Gotcha. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking with Rachel Hurris, author of That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. Let's go to the phones to Helene in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi.
Well, I'm hoping that you can solve a lifelong problem for me. I was raised a vegetarian, and as were my kids, and I cannot for the life of me figure out how people decide to be utterly repulsed by one kind of dead animal where they think that the other kind of dead animal looks good, smells good, tastes good, and yeah, I'm just curious to hear the answer to that.
You mean like why someone who's a meat eater can eat a cow but not a cat? Or a cat
exactly.
is repulsive?
Exactly. You've got it right there.
Okay.
Like when my kids, somebody gave our family a ham one time for Christmas, and my kids carried it out and buried it, and they were just grossed out. Well, I realize it's somewhat, from what you're saying, societal, but there has to be more to it than that because people get really grossed out over a cat but not a cow, and they're both dead.
Well, some people eat cats, don't they?
Well, that's actually a great question. And in fact, there are cultures, for instance, in China where cats can be eaten. And your issue about pets versus the things we find in the supermarket is exactly the issue of an animal that we bring into our home and bring into our family. So we bring our cats and dogs into our lives like we bring children in. And the idea of eating them is close to the concept of cannibalism and, you know, completely abhorrent. Whereas the thing that we see in the supermarket when we go to the meat section, first of all, it's lost all connection to its animal origins. You know, you don't see the animal at all. You see this carved piece of something or other that's been bled, it's been packaged, it's in cellophane. So here's this thing, this protein that you enjoy consuming, and you purchase it. I've actually wondered if people had to do more serious hunting, you know, whether or not they would be a little bit more reluctant to eat food. And or if we had to see, you know, eye to eye the whole cow, you know, hanging dead in the butcher shop, whether we would be so excited about a filet mignon. But again, I think it's our experience. And the key thing here is it's the meaning that we apply to the trigger that determines whether or not it's disgusting or acceptable or even delicious.
Gabrielle in Palo Alto. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
We're originally from Mexico, and the question is that papaya is actually a fairly frequent staple food, and I find the smell, it just smells like vomit to me, and my wife and daughter absolutely love it, and I found that this is that I'm not the only case. So I'm curious of how same food can have such a different impact on the smell. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
So that's also a very interesting question. And part of it may have been Gabrielle's original experiences with the smell of papaya being different from his wife and his daughter. But it's also the case that recent genetic work has discovered that, in fact, everybody has a unique nose. And Gabrielle may have certain receptors inside his nose that are particularly attuned to one or two aspects of the papaya bouquet that make it unpleasant for him, whereas his wife and his daughter do not, and potentially the other people he knows have the same issue. Or they've have a combination of this issue plus a bad experience with a papaya in the past.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book, Getting Off of Foods for a Little Bit, about other disgust, that people are disgusted with their bodies. Why would our bodies disgust us?
Well, we're not usually so disgusted by our bodies, but we're disgusted by other people's bodies and specifically the things that come from their bodies. And that's because one of the key features of the emotion of disgust is to keep the outside, especially the outside stuff coming from other people, away from our inside. And this is the connection with disease as well. So we want to protect ourselves from becoming contaminated by the cooties and the oozy gooies of other people. However, again, the situation and the context makes an enormous difference. So, you know, a stranger's saliva, someone who licks your face in a grocery store, for example, that you have no idea who they are, that's going to be horrendously repulsive. But if your lover does that to you in the bedroom, it could be totally erotic. So again, it's the meaning of the situation, it's the meaning of the trigger that determines if it's disgusting or delightful.
So that odors that you give off may not smell so bad to yourself, but the same odors someone else gives off smells
absolutely
awful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just our own odors. We think that the odors of the things that make our family or ourselves are also okay. So, for example, if you're changing your own baby's diaper, that dirty nappy smells okay to you. But if you had another infant of the same age, their dirty diaper would smell gross. And it's even the case that we think that our own dog's breath is better than a stranger's dog's breath. So, you know, the things that we bring into our family, into our home, the intimates, those people are okay when it comes to their body products typically. But the outsider, the stranger, that's where it gets dubious and disgusting.
Talking with Rachel Herz, author of That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, being happy to be disgusting this afternoon with you. Let's go to the phones and see who else can join the crowd. Erin in Salt Lake City. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
Hi there.
So this parlays nicely into what you guys were just talking about. I'm a nurse practitioner, and in the medical field, it's kind of a longstanding joke that there are certain things, you know, one person can deal with blood and guts, but another person can't, or one person deals with the top part of the body, and the other person can't stand that part, but can deal with the bottom part of the body. And I just find it really fascinating that, you know, that those things that disgust us sort of translate into this. Well, my one thing, I can't handle oral care, or I can't handle blood or poop or pee. So I think it's really interesting that that's kind of, you know, translates into the medical profession as well.
Wait, let me ask you something. Don't go away yet, Erin, because I want to ask how long have you been doing this in this profession?
About 10 years.
And doesn't get any easier as you get older at it?
certain things for me, it's cough and sputum. No, it does not get any easier. But I'm a women's health nurse practitioner, and so lots of people would find what I do quite disgusting.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Erin.
Yeah,
have a good
thanks.
Weekend. Bye. Do people get better acclimated, Rachel, as they get older to what's disgusting or being more accommodating?
People definitely get better acclimated as they get older. But just going back to Erin's point, it's also the case that we all have our disgust personality predispositions. So one person may be more disgusted by certain things, let's say oral care, and someone else is more disgusted by poop, or someone else is more disgusted by dead things, and someone else is more disgusted by blood. So, you know, or moral issues. So it really depends. It's actually a personality variable as well. But it's also the case that everybody, regardless of their personality, as they get older, they get less disgust sensitive. And it's not necessarily clear why that happens, but there are some interesting hypotheses if you'd like me to share them.
Sure.
Well, one idea sort of stems back from everything we've been saying so far, which is just that as you get older, you've been there, done that, seen it so many times, smelt it so many times, et cetera, so you're more used to it. It's less disgusting. Mm-hmm. Another possibility is that the neurotransmitters in the brain that are controlling the disgust experience are damping down. They're less active. There's less of it, so we get less of an intense response. But what I think sort of philosophically is my favorite possibility is that disgust really at its core is about our fear of death and our trying to protect ourselves from death in all sorts of ways. And as we get to the end of our life, maybe we've become somewhat more accepting of that fact, and therefore the whole gamut of things that are disgusting become less of an issue or a problem for us.
Does disgust about morality work the same way? Violence, disgusted with violence and, you know, things like that?
Well, again, I think it's, you know, that's a really great question, and that has to do both with your exposure and your experience. For instance, you know, if you're exposed to a lot of violence and a lot of bloodshed, I think that you do definitely become inured to it. At the same time, I think certain professions, like if you're a police officer, for instance, and you have to deal with shootouts and accidents and that sort of stuff, because you're constantly reminded of your mortality, in fact, you know, assuming that you're not particularly old, you might become more disgusted at things. Because, in fact, when we're reminded of our imminent demise or, you know, demise at some point, we do become more disgust sensitive. So it could work in a variety of ways.
All right. We're going to take a short break and come back more and talk with Rachel Herz. She's author of That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We want to hear about what disgusts you, but only if we can say it on the radio. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Rachel Herz about her book, That's Disgusting. Not her, the book title. Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion, our number 1-800-989-8255. One last question for you that I was thinking, reading the book, is why are we drawn to horror movies, you know, which feature dismembered bodies, gory stuff, chainsaw massacres, things like that?
Well, that's also a fantastic question, and it's connected to the issue of death again and something else. So first of all, with respect to death, I think that the horror show enables us to explore some of the mystery of the extremes of death, you know, Freddy killing all these people in incredibly crazy ways. And we think, well, you know, it couldn't be that bad. So if we can tolerate that, then maybe some of the fear of our real death is attenuated somewhat and sort of the mystery is taken out a little bit. Another answer to the question is to do with this seemingly strange predilection that we have called benign masochism. And that is that we actually like to do things which seem dangerous or seem disgusting or horrifying as long as they don't actually really hurt us. So, for example, bungee jumping, taking roller coaster rides, eating habanero peppers, doing those sorts of things and going to see horror movies is like testing the limits. And we seem to enjoy doing that as long as it's not actually going to cause us harm.
Yeah, we used to call those cheap thrills back in the day.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Rachel, for taking time to be with us today. A very enjoyable, very readable book. Very exciting.
Thank you very much, Ira, too.
Rachel Herz, author of That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion.